Blog Talk Radio.
From the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona, you're listening to Breakthrough Thinking. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Dave Isaac, the host of Breakthrough Thinking. And if it is the third Tuesday of each month, it is Family Law Hour, starring guest host Dan Ortega III. Daniel, how are you?
Good. I'm glad to be back here. It's good to see you guys again.
I know. This is great. It's such an important topic, too.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, it's craziness out there in terms of family disputes. It's unfortunate. It's really sad, actually.
It's an unfortunate reality.
Yeah, that's the way that could be a book. Unfortunate reality. I like that.
I should write book titles.
Yeah.
I cannot write books, but I could probably write a good book
title. That would be a good book title. But it is, unfortunately, very difficult, and the law is complex. Anytime there's anything with the legal situation, it's complex. I know tax law, and that's complex. And I think every law.
No, thank you.
I know it's just the legal system itself sometimes might be slow to move, but you can only do what you can do because that's the legal system, and they're backed up at times, right?
The gears move very slowly when it comes to our justice system, but nonetheless, they move, and that's the best part about it. Is that no matter how long it takes, our judicial system always wants to make sure that right decision is made, justice is done. So
yeah. It's probably better than any other system, right, in the world, do you think?
Our legal system?
Yeah. Maybe not.
Depends.
Oh.
I mean, sometimes I think my Wii Nintendo Entertainment System.
Oh.
Well, legal system. Than our judicial
system. The Nintendo system, you're probably right, yeah. But I mean, other countries probably, I don't know.
Oh, and comparative to the rest of the countries. Yeah. I guess that's... Our legal system is part of the reason why people claim that this is, one of the best countries in the world.
Yeah, so that's, something to note. It may not be perfect, but hopefully...
Debatable, absolutely.
Yeah, so we'll have to definitely... hopefully, it will improve. But today's show is about legal decision-making and parenting time.
Right.
And appears what? That was a change, evidently, in this last January?
Yeah, January 1st, 2013, new law went into effect. Basically, what the courts are trying to do and the legislature is trying to do is remove, kind of phase out the term custody, so to speak. And now what they're replacing it with is legal decision-making authority. Parenting time, it exists the same way it did before January 1st, but even that term was changed from visitation.
Mm.
It used to be called visitation, and that was visitation was something that was given to the non-custodial parent. So there had to be orders in place to make sure that the parent whom the child did not stay with had an opportunity to visit with the child, to have their parenting time. So that terminology changed into parenting time, and now they're really trying to move the idea, the word custody, out of the family courts altogether and move it towards legal decision making, because technically that's what it is. And custody is, it's kind of a confusing concept, and a lot of people actually confuse custody with what parenting time actually is.
Yeah, that's what I always thought.
A lot of people thought custody was, how much time the child spent with each parent.
Because by definition, if you have custody of something, I always think of physical possession.
Right, exactly.
But maybe not necessarily.
Not in this circumstance. Yeah. And that's now there are two forms of custody as they existed before the law went into effect on January 1st. There was legal custody. And there was physical custody. And that's, there was a lot of confusion even between physical custody and parenting time. So now what the idea is, legal custody was the ability to make legal decisions on behalf of the child, to make medical decisions, educational decisions, religious decisions. And now And then you had the other part, which was physical custody. Who would have the child primarily? Who was the custodial parent? So those were the two branches of custody, so to speak. But now the state of Arizona wants to move towards just calling it what it is, legal decision-making authority. And that's they've narrowed it down. They've removed the concept of custody. They removed the concept of physical custody and legal custody, and just kind of moved it into what it really is, and that's legal decision-making authority. And coupled with parenting time is now just how much time the kid spends with each parent.
Kids, so that's kids, it. Whatever. So it's possible to have 100% joint, 100% legal custody, and no physical and no parenting time. It's possible.
Well,
at the extreme, right?
Well, I'm going to correct you right away. It's not custody; it's legal decision making.
So would that be possible? Have one parent have 100% legal,
sole legal decision making,
but to have zero parenting time? Is that even possible? I mean, it's not practical, but would legal decision making, sole legal decision making, automatically assume you have to have the majority of parenting time?
Not necessarily.
Yeah. So it is possible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it wouldn't make sense.
Right,
but.
Right. And those are two concepts that are looked at differently. Because legal decision making really looks to the ability of the parents to be able to adequately co-parent the child or the children. Are there circumstances that exist in the relationship that show that the parents can or cannot adequately and civilly?
So let me ask you, that's a very interesting question or statement. Ability to co-parent. So if the courts find that two people are just so incompatible at current times that they can never get along, so it's either 50-50 or 100-0? Is there anything in between when it comes to legal decision making?
There are areas in between, but the main areas are, you know, there's either sole legal decision making authority or joint legal decision.
See, that makes sense to me, because how do you have?
Mm-hmm. But there's a lot in between those two spectrums.
What would be in between that? How does that work?
Let's say, for example, the parties have joint legal decision making authority, but one of the parents has final decision making authority as to any of the issues, or all of them, or just a few of them. So let's just take, for example, I'm in a relationship with somebody, we get a divorce, or we have to enter orders for the child. Under a joint legal decision-making authority, you would have to basically come together to have a conversation about how to see if the two parties can come to agreements as to whatever the particular decisions on the table right now. Let's just say school. We got joint legal decision making. We should come together, talk about it, see if we can come to a consensus. But let's say one of the parties has the final decision making authority. Well, after that entire colloquy takes place and that discussion takes place between the two parents, one of the parents, if they have final decision making authority, could just say, okay, well, you know what, we're not coming to agreements. Since I'm the final decision-making person under the order, this is what I want to happen, and this is what will happen.
How often do you see that?
More often than not. I mean, it's,
really?
Because there's any number of reasons why you can have final decision-making authority. I've even seen it where, and it's pretty common, where you have joint legal decision-making authority, but one of the parents might have final decision-making authority as to just one of those three main areas, educational, medical, religious. And now, even at the beginning of this year, another wrinkle that the legislature has thrown into this idea of legal decision-making authority is personal care.
What is that?
The four main areas. Personal care, that's the thing, is the legislature didn't really give us much of a definition of what personal care is supposed to mean. And it can mean anything from haircuts to piercings to tattoos things like that.
Okay. That would make sense.
So you might see a situation where the parties have joint legal decision-making authority, but they're split amongst their final decision-making authority as to those four areas, so to speak. One parent, I used to work in the family court, for a judge, and I would see most often where there was a dispute as to final decision-making authority. Let's say one of the parents was a nurse, Okay.
Oh, okay.
Well, you know what? The judge, she might give final decision-making authority as the medical decision
Makes
to
sense.
the nurse, if that's what she asked for, if they can put on a good case as to why.
And if one was a professor?
As the educational decision.
How about
like,
if
yeah.
one was stupid? Just kidding, ladies
right,
and
right.
gentlemen. But it's a possibility.
Yeah,
right?
yeah, yeah. So the reality is, there's any number of combinations of legal decision-making authority that exist.
Is that a negotiating tool that the judge
absolutely,
uses?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah. And, I've even seen it in a circumstance where, I did see one case where a couple came in and the mother asked for joint legal decision-making, but for her to have final decision-making authority as to all medical decisions because... she wanted to get her daughter braces. She's a high school kid or, you know, in a junior high age. Her teeth are sticking every which way out of her mouth. And mom wants to take the child to go get braces, but dad won't agree for her to be able to take the kid to the doctor or to get the braces. So the reality was that she needed the braces. And there were a bunch of other health considerations. You know, there's so much that's linked to your oral hygiene.
So the judge made the decision, I suspect, and say, hey, this is in the best interest of the kid. You got medical decision.
Right. And
could have even finely tuned more than that, just part of a medical decision, just braces, but overall medical. Could it even be sorted that way?
Well, then you would be looking at just asking the judge for something specific. I mean,
okay.
What you want to do is file a motion to say, hey, judge, we can't agree, so we need you to issue an order as to whether or not this kid can get braces or not. But what ended up happening in that case is the father just the judge felt that father was just being a little bit unreasonable with withholding his consent for the child to get braces, and aside from all the health concerns. Which are the main points. I mean,
sure.
You got to think about what this little girl is going to go through.
That makes sense. Yeah, that
you know,
totally makes
in,
sense.
You know, a high school setting or in a social
yeah.
setting, you know, that's not fun for kids. So the judge found that, you know, dad was being a little bit unreasonable and withholding his consent, so he awarded mother final decision-making authority as to all medical decisions. But they still maintain joint legal decision-making, which requires that the two parents sit down and actually discuss all the options and see if they can first come to agreements. If
yeah.
not, then in that case, mom would be the final decider and say, okay, she's getting the braces.
So to me, it sounds like if someone has final decision making, the joint is just, what would the word be? What am I trying to think of?
I'm not sure. We're
the word would be like meaningless.
Well, it does in the sense that, I mean, well, you have to look at it in the context when you compare it to solely the decision-making authority.
Yeah.
In that case, the parent who has that authority to make the decision solely on their own, they don't have to have that discussion. They don't have to even try to come to agreements. They can make the decision on their own, and that's it.
Let me ask you this, Danny. How many reasonable divorces have you seen? I rest my case. No, think about this. No, really.
Right.
I think there so many motives is revenge.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen it. I've seen it.
Sure.
I mean, you're an attorney, but I've seen it enough doing a lot of seminars and things like that. Being a member of single parent associations, I've seen a lot of this. And it's not pretty, obviously. But I would question someone that would agree to joint legal decision-making but lose final decision.
Mm-hmm.
What I would suggest is if they had joint legal decision-making but at the final end of it have an arbitration, have some type of mediation and binding, by the way,
mm-hmm.
binding arbitration, or I guess it's called binding mediation, whatever it's called.
Those exist in the family court. They do have...
That makes a lot of sense because then you got a third party of reason separating the emotions
right.
from one of the parties or both of the parties. Does
right.
that make sense?
Well, what happens is, I mean, that happens in family court. A lot of times when you enter into a final order or there's a decree or there's a stipulation between the parties to come to, you know, to certain terms, usually the court will impose or the parties will agree that if there are any future disputes as to anything, that they'll first go to a parenting coordinator before coming back to the court and, you know, seeking judicial intervention. So it's kind of what you're explaining, the arbitration, mediation, whatever it may be. But they try to see if the if the couple can resolve, or if the parents can resolve the issue without coming to the court first.
So what we're saying, it appears to me, is that the judge, or let me ask you, would the judge more than likely agree to not having one of the parents have final decision making, and instead saying joint legal decision making, if you can't make a decision, then you automatically have to go to binding arbitration? Is that something the judge would favor?
Yeah, so, that happens. That happens, absolutely.
Why would a judge intervene and say, no, this parent A, you get final decision making? Why would they do that? Under what circumstances?
Well, like the one that I explained.
Yeah.
When one of the parties is being reasonable and withholding consent.
That makes sense.
Uh-huh. And, you know, when it comes to any of those three areas, I mean, it just depends on the circumstances. They have to be taken on a case-by-case basis, and the example I give you is just one.
And that does make sense. Mm-hmm. And so as an attorney, for the listeners out there, because these are new terms, these are new ways. In fact, let me just mention, when I got divorced and I was in a big custody battle, mm-hmm. it was like 17 or 18 years ago. Mm-hmm. Does that make me old?
No.
Okay, good.
You're only as old as you think you are.
Hey, I like your way of thinking. They had a concept called primary parent.
Right.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, primary
parent. So that's no longer an issue, is it? That's gone.
Yeah.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. They try to get rid of the idea of custody, and they just split it up into what's called parenting time now. And parenting is just a bright line. You know, what time is the kid with each parent?
So let me ask you, as an attorney, I know it depends on the facts and circumstances of each case,
mm-hmm.
but as an attorney, generally, would you push for final decision-making for your client, or would you say, okay, let's just go legal decision-making with binding arbitration? Pros and cons for each one.
Well, I always like to start in the middle, unless, you know, the parent comes to me with a number of reasons as to why they should have these things. And a lot of times, parents, when they come to me, they don't realize that there's all these little subsets of joint legal decision-making.
Yeah.
You can actually divvy it up.
Which is interesting to me. I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Have you done that, divvy it up?
Yeah, absolutely. Uh-huh.
How would you divvy it up? Before you answer that question, how would you divvy it up? Based on expertise, if the wife or the husband's a nurse or doctor, that'd be one way.
Sometimes even the parents agree to divvy it up. There are parents out there that agree that, you know what, you know what, you're the doctor. Maybe you should have, you know, the final legal decision making, but that's only if I get final legal decision making as to all educational decisions.
So you can
I mean,
get the religious
part.
One, I'll take the education,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you take personal care, and I'll take medical.
Yeah.
And that is so interesting, though. I never knew that could happen.
Yeah, and I mean, the parents have the ability to divvy that up, and the court has the ability to divvy that up.
And then the court, if there's an agreement, the court will usually say, yeah, if you guys agree, we're okay.
Check, yeah. I mean, that's what the court always wants to see. They want to see
Makes
the parents...
sense.
Controlling their own destiny and deciding how they're going to co-parent the children. And one of the things that the judge that I used to work for, and a lot of the family court judges, they usually have this conversation with the parents. And that's, you know, listen, guys, I don't know your kid. I'll probably never see your kid. And only the most that I get of your situation is what's said to me inside of these four walls,
right.
The courtroom, so
right.
to speak. You know, I can't see what goes on outside of this. So if you want a complete stranger that doesn't know you or your child or your circumstance to make these decisions, okay, I'll do it. Pitch it to me, and I'll make the decision. But it's always better. You guys know your circumstances better. You know your child better. You know what's in your child's best interest. So it's always better for you guys to come to agreements on how you're going to co-parent the child. And that's what they always encourage. And when the parents do come to those agreements, I mean, unless it's something completely crazy.
Right.
Most of the time, the court will look at it and say, all right, this is what you guys agreed to. I'll sign off. It's order of the court.
And basically, the four areas, like you said, medical,
mm-hmm.
education, religious, and personal care.
Personal care, yeah.
Is there any other things you can think of?
Mm-hmm.
How about outside activities, sports programs? ballerina types, you know, for women, you know, well.
Yeah, I mean, extracurricular activities and things like that.
Where would that fall?
I mean, if, let's say, for example, I have a parenting time order that has, you know, me with my kid every week, week on, week off. Let's just take that for example. If I wanted to enroll the child into an extracurricular activity that took place during my parenting time and I paid for all the expense, absolutely, I could do that.
What about a situation if, whether it's a little daughter. I mean, they play all sorts of sports these days too, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
But traditionally, you know, they go into figure skating, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And they go on the road because they're on a team and they have to travel.
Mm-hmm.
Or a little guy that wants to play baseball or whatever, hockey, mm-hmm. and they travel.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't determine always when these tournaments will happen.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle a situation like that if the parent who has them at a tournament that they're supposed to be in Colorado, let's say they live in Arizona,
mm-hmm.
And the tournament's during the other parent's time that is not involved,
mm-hmm.
what happens?
I mean, the parent who's entitled to the parenting time during that tournament has the ability to refuse it. But, I mean, they have a right to say,
yeah.
That's my parenting time. You know, particularly if they didn't agree to it. Let's say the other parent just kind of put them into the figure skating.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Without the consent of the other parent or knowledge or agreement, whatever it may be, the parent who has the, you know, parenting time at that moment can say, you know, this is my parenting time. I don't agree to it. That's just the way it's going to be.
And that's it. So the,
mm-hmm.
the only thing then I suspect you can do is up front in the agreement put in stipulations that under these conditions, if the kid has made a travel team or something, regardless of whose time it is, A or B named parent
mm-hmm.
will take them and make up for the time. Is that something you could do?
You can agree to just about.
It's like a business transaction
anything
with emotions.
If the two parents have the ability to decide how they're going to co-parent.
Now, have you ever seen that happen where one of the parents is against sports, for example,
mm-hmm.
and the other says, no, this is really important for many reasons because usually youth sports, you learn more than just the sport.
Mm-hmm.
It's about life.
Yeah.
Would the judge intervene and say, no, you're being unreasonable. We think if this kid's good enough, they should go, even if it's on your time, but you'll compensate during the year. Would the judge intervene, or if it's just a disagreement, it's off the table?
Yeah. I mean, I've seen people litigate a myriad amount of issues, this being one of them. But for the most part, on a baseline, just from a baseline stance, if it is your parenting time, and you do not agree to allow the kid to go, then that's your right to do that.
But you could put an exception in the agreement, though.
Yeah, absolutely. You can agree to anything.
Yeah. That's interesting, which makes it, I mean, I guess the bottom line, if you have two reasonable parents, and if it's in the best interest of the child, you would hope.
You want to play nice.
You would, well, not only nice, but you'd hope both parties would say, yeah, that's in the best interest.
Yeah, sure.
So that would be... Well, that's interesting. Now, getting back to the question that you think I forgot.
Okay.
We were in the middle of it when I asked it. As an attorney, would you push, I mean, I know there's every case is different, but would you push for final decision-making or binding arbitration? And what I'm asking is to me it sounds a little dangerous if you push for final decision-making if it's an all-or-nothing situation. So both parties, I want final, and party B, I want final, and it's all-or-nothing. Or would the judge intervene and say, no, you also have this option of arbitration?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Because, I mean, all-or-nothing is scary. That's like high-stakes poker.
All right. Well, a lot of the time, parents don't... they don't fight over the idea of final decision-making authority.
They don't.
If they were going to fight, I mean, not that they don't, but I'm just saying in the context of your question, they would probably fight more often for sole legal decision-making. That's where the fight would take place. So, because a lot of the families don't know about this idea of final decision-making authority.
Yeah,
if they wanted, if either party wanted that final decision-making
mm-hmm.
authority, then what they would probably be pushing for is for sole legal decision-making authority.
Yeah.
But now, in your case, to address the question, if they're both fighting for final decision making authority, the judge could award it. He could not. It really depends on the facts and what you present to the judge.
Is it default rule then going 50-50?
Yeah, the baseline that most judges start with is joint legal decision making authority.
And is that So they might start with that, but if one pushes final, they'll go, no, you can't get final, I'll give you legal, a joint.
Mm-hmm. Right,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, so there's not, it's not a, a real adverse circumstance to ask for the moon.
No.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you have a reasonable basis.
Yeah, you got to be able to back it up, though.
Yeah, otherwise it just looks like you're doing a power trip, and
exactly.
You just probably know that.
Right.
But, okay, well, let's take a quick break. This is really interesting to me. I just find this fascinating, and, of course, when I went through my custody battle divorce, I learned quickly that it was there's emotions, but if you can separate it, still you want your kids. But if you look at it as a transaction, you can accelerate things. And that's what I learned long ago,
right. The
hard way. Mine took 2 years.
Ooh, wow.
That's a long time, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah, no fun. Anyway, this is Breakthrough Thinking, live from the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. And third Tuesday of each month, it is the Family Law Show, starring guest host Daniel Ortega III. This is fascinating. We want to give the phone number out right now for Daniel. If you want to talk to him, 602-752-0763, 602-752-0763, or you can email Daniel at law@gmail.com. That's D-R-O, D as in Daniel, R as in Robert, O as in Oscar, 3, law@gmail.com, and we will be right back.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIAdvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
Ridenour, Hyten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Hyten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
At Beerenbaum Baum and Spien PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Beerenbaum and Spien works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Live from the Regis Suites, we are back. And, of course, this is Phoenix, Arizona. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking, and the third Tuesday of each Monday, it is the Family Law Hour, starring guest host Daniel Ortega III. And, Daniel, this is a very important show today.
I just got to interrupt real quick.
What did I say?
The third Tuesday of each Monday.
I said that?
Yes, you did.
Did I say that, Daniel?
You didn't catch it.
We didn't catch it. You're
right. Oh, I catch everything.
The third Tuesday of each Monday.
Each Monday, huh?
I said that to see if you would catch it and if the listeners out there would catch it. Greg, that is a good catch. Is that a good catch? Give yourself a round of applause.
Thank you. In my head, I'll take it. Yes.
Wow, that was very good. But the third Tuesday of each month. I want to hear a replay of that. I don't think I said that. Okay, but we'll hear it. I was just going to say, if you want to hear a replay of this valuable information, go to BreakRadioShow.com, go under Archives. That's BreakRadioShow.com. Go to Archives under, is it under the Divorce Show or Family Law? I think it's the Divorce Show, right? Yeah, and we could change the title of that. But you can hear a complete replay. This is valuable information, and I got to tell you, it's important to be forewarned is to be armed. I mean, you have to understand the law. It's like a CPA. I always tell other CPAs and people, know the facts and know the law.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know the law, you don't know. I mean, if you don't know the facts, you don't know what law to apply.
Right.
And if you don't know the law, then what good are facts, right?
Funny saying about that. I actually learned this from a lawyer when I worked in juvenile dependency and delinquency court, and I thought it was hilarious. She's like, when the facts aren't on your side,
pound on the table.
Pound the law. Pound the law.
Yeah, or when they're on your side.
Yeah, or when the facts are on your side,
pound the law.
You pound the facts.
Yeah.
When the law is on your side, you pound the law. When neither the law or the facts are on your side, you pound the table.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
Yeah.
I was in a very, well, as a CPA, we had a couple clients battling each other. One was an ex-client, and I was one of the partners. So the main partner of that client, I was one of the founding partners, mm-hmm. said, Dave, can you go to the hearing? You know pretty much this client. Mm-hmm. So I went, and one of the attorneys brought that up. When you don't have the facts or the law on your side, pound the table, because the other attorney was pounding the table, literally. And so he properly brought it up just at that moment.
And really, I've seen it happen.
Oh, I bet you have. Well, yeah, they're just trying some intimidation.
Something,
right?
Yeah, something. Got to throw something out there.
That's pretty funny. Well, it could be funny. But anyway, so this is very interesting. We were talking about joint legal decision-making.
Mm-hmm. That has replaced the concept of custody here in Arizona.
Yeah, and we haven't got to parenting time yet, but we do want to talk a little bit about who would ever get sole legal decision making. What are the criteria? What would cause a judge to say, you're out of here like an umpire, and mm-hmm. parent A gets sole legal decision? How do you get that?
When you have two parties in family court, and one of them is seeking sole legal decision making. And, you know, quite frankly, a lot of my clients come to me, you know, more often than not. I mean, every now and then you get the food clients that'll come in and say, yeah, I'm fine with joint legal decision. But more often than not, you get the parents that come in and say, I want to have sole. I want to be the one to make the decisions.
Really?
Just because they don't want to have to deal with the other parent. But unfortunately,
okay.
Part of co-parenting is dealing
with
the other parent. So they come in and they want sole. And, you know, usually the rundown that I go with them is, okay, is there a history of domestic violence in your relationship? Is there, does the other parent have a history of drug abuse, child abuse? Spouse abuse? Have they been convicted of any serious crimes against children? Basically, anything that would pose a danger and would make it inadequate for the two parents to be able to co-parent. And I think that those are circumstances where one parent wouldn't be able to co-parent with the other.
That makes sense.
So those are the areas I usually run down. Either got to be, you know, a child abuser, a drug user, or a murderer. I'd say that very generically, but that's kind of what we're looking at.
So it's a tough one. In other words, then 9 times out of 10, you're going to see joint legal decision.
Mm-hmm. Unless you got a parent that's just screwed up.
Just wacko.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then how would wacko be defined?
I don't think that's a legal term.
Oh, okay. We could probably make a few things up. But,
yeah, when I started law school, they required us to buy the largest version of Black's Law Dictionary.
It was
huge. I mean, and I felt like, why couldn't I get a pocket, you know, smaller version of
it? Yeah, that would make sense.
And I don't think Wacko was ever in there.
Waco might have been there, but not Wacko. The judges, I mean, every parent probably says other things about the other parent, you know, whether it's under their breath to their attorney. Unfortunately, some say it in front of the kids, and that's probably no-no.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to say things in front of the kids.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's most divorces, I suspect, you know, there's some anger, there's some emotions involved.
Absolutely.
So would the judge look at that? I mean, how fine a line is it? I mean, you mentioned some very serious things why someone gets sole legal decision-making,
mm-hmm.
but we're trying to define the word wacko. So in other words, I'm just wondering if there's indication that one parent really doesn't want to co-parent, where let's say one parent is more often than not saying, you know, maybe some profanity in front of the kids, maybe they're bad-mouthing the, let's say, the mother or father, depending who the parent is, in front of the kids, you know, and saying very derogatory comments. How does a judge look at that?
I mean, it depends on what's said, where it's said. I mean, you got to look at the entire circumstance. And is this something that happens frequently? How frequently? You know, how close together are the incidents? But for the most part, I mean, the things that you kind of laid out aren't really reasons to provide sole legal decision making to one parent over the other. And the reality is, I mean, to address the concern that you're kind of bringing up right now, a lot of times in consent decrees, which is consent decrees are when the parties stick together and they agree with how the divorce is going to go. That's consent, operative word there. A lot of times in orders, let's say they take the issue to trial, and final orders, there's usually a paragraph in there that says that, you know, the parents are to encourage love between the child and the other parent, and they're not to disparage the other
parent's
character in the presence of the child. I've seen those paragraphs, and they're pretty standard. I mean, the parents like to know that that's in there. The reality is there a lot of teeth to it? I don't know. I couldn't say for sure, because you never really know what one parent saying to the child in the privacy of their own home, unless, you know, the child goes and repeats it or whatnot. But yeah, it's a nice paragraph that's put in there just to kind of, you know, let the parties know, listen, it's not in the best interest of the child for you to disparage or degrade or demean the other parent in the presence of the child or just directly to the child.
Yeah.
But the reality is, you know, in the real world, you get that trash talking between, you know, of of the other parent that happens in relationships that fall apart more often than not. Because,
yeah.
I mean, it's all built on emotion. You know, a lot of people have difficulty being able to control that sometimes, and they feel the best way to get back at the other parent is to try to turn the child against them.
I believe that. So in this case, the wacko, I don't want to say defense, it's really the wacko attack is not very powerful.
Not really. I mean, again, we really have to define this term wacko in the context of this radio show right now. But I mean, if we're defining wacko as somebody that's like clinically insane, that's probably a good reason to give the other parent full legal decision making authority. But if we're talking about somebody that, I mean,
bipolar?
The definition of wacko. I mean, parents can be bipolar and still be able to parent their children.
Really?
It's possible. It's possible.
Hmm.
I mean, psychologically,
effectively?
Possibly. I mean, possibly not. It really depends. Like, it's every situation is so different. Every family is so different. They're like fingerprints. There's not one circumstance that's really the same.
So would it be advisable in certain circumstances, if we could define the word wacko, in terms of if someone you suspect has some mental disorder, and of course we're not psychologists, but if you suspect that, Would a psychological evaluation be appropriate?
Yeah, that would be a basis for awarding sole legal decision. I mean, if that psychological evaluation took place and it showed, you know, something to the detriment of the parent that was being evaluated, those could be any number of reasons if they were to diagnose them with something.
Let me ask you this: is the custody evaluation the same as a psychological evaluation? Can it be different?
Sometimes a psychological evaluation can be contained within a custody evaluation.
Well, usually, in our case, I remember it was a custody evaluation, and part of it was some Minnesota test. I forgot what it was called. It was some test. I must have come out okay on that one. But,
I'm sure.
Yeah. No, well, I seem to have done well in the court situation here. So. But what I'm thinking is, could you just get a psychological evaluation, since a custody evaluation is rather costly, but would that be something effective as an attorney as a tool to say, hey, we feel, we didn't do a custody evaluation for whatever reason, but we did a psychological evaluation, and we feel it could be harmful for the child to be in the custody or...
Yeah, you can ask the court to do
just a psychological test.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
I've seen that happen before.
Yeah, I haven't heard of that.
And then, you know, when you get into the huge, custody evaluations, that encompasses a lot more than just the psyche of the parents. I mean, there's so much more, like living situation, economic situation, the family situation. I mean, the custody evaluations are a lot more extensive. It's literally...
Oh, yeah.
At a wider picture, whereas the psychological evaluation, we're just looking into the brain of this one person.
Yeah, yeah, if they have one. Okay, so, what, am I bitter or what?
Not yet.
I'm just kidding. I'm sure both sides think the same thing.
Right.
I'm just playing devil's advocate. I'm playing both sides here. But that is interesting, because there's a lot to this, and people, I think, should know this. This is very interesting, this show. I like this a lot, actually. And we may have created a new term. So we haven't talked about parenting time. Why don't we take another quick break, and then let's talk about parenting time, because that is something new. And to me, that's really interesting how it's separated from the legal decision-making, and I think the listeners will be really interested in that as well. And we're here with Daniel Ortega III, attorney, great attorney, family law. Please call him, because even if you have a question, right, I'm sure you'd love to talk to people. 602-752-0763, 602-752-0763. Email him if you want at D as in Daniel, R as in Robert, O as in Oscar, the number 3 law@gmail.com, and we'll be right back. Than a cannonball.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIAdvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
Parenting time, which evidently is different than legal decision making.
Yeah.
So how does that work, parenting time?
Not real simply. It's just the amount of time that the child spends with each parent, what time the kid is supposed to be with each parent, and for how long of a time.
Hmm.
And, you know, the baseline, again, that the courts always start with is 50-50 parenting time. You know, the parents get equal access to the child.
Actually.
Yeah, and you know, based on whatever arguments you make, you know, if it does come down where you pitch it to the judge to determine parenting time, you know, you kind of put your points as to why you think you should get what it is you're asking for. A lot of time parents come to agreements that, you know, give one parent disproportionately more time than the other, but some parents are willing to agree to that.
So this is interesting to me as I'm hearing what you're saying, defining and listening to this whole show. Is to me, it seems like if you can get 50-50 legal decision making, that seems like the more, well, I don't want to say more important, but maybe the harder battle. Because parenting time, if the presumption is 50-50 starting out the gate, why would the judge say, no, you have 70-30 or you have, you know, 80-20? Or why would a judge give more parenting time to another parent? If they had, let's say, legal joint.
There could be a bunch of reasons. Let's just start out with some simple ones. Let's just say one of the parents just works, you know, an extensive amount of hours during the week.
Okay.
That they actually won't be available to care for the child.
So that'd be one reason.
Basis. Another one would be what kind of home environment does the parent have? Is it one that could be to the detriment to the child? If so, that can lead a parent to get less parenting time or more, or the other to get more. It really depends on the positions that the family, that each side takes. But those are just a couple of examples.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. And so what do you tell your clients between parenting time and joint legal decision is, did I make the correct assumption that it seems to me that the joint legal decision making would be a good hurdle? If you can achieve that, you're doing okay.
Yeah, if you can achieve joint legal decision making, you're in a good place. But yeah, a lot of times people want to fight over the legal decision making, and that sometimes can be more of a battle than the actual parenting time.
Yeah, because if they start with like 50-50, mm-hmm. and you can show, hey, I can, you know, schedule my work around it,
mm-hmm.
then a judge is going to be really listening carefully, like, why not then?
Right. And, well, even within parenting time, there are subsets.
Oh, there are. What do we got there? This is interesting.
And those, quite simply, are supervised and unsupervised parenting time. So another reason that a parent could get a limited amount of parenting time, let's just say that there were allegations of abuse, be they physical abuse, child abuse,
right.
Drug abuse. One of the parents is still entitled to parenting time. They might get a couple of weekends a month because it's probably just not that safe to leave the kid exposed.
So
for any reason for a long period of time. So, I've seen it where a parent will have parenting time, but it will be supervised. It needs to be supervised.
Gotcha.
By somebody. Somebody needs to be there, either like an independent third party or a family member of some sort. But basically, in those cases, when it comes to supervised parenting time, the court just doesn't want to leave the child alone with that parent. But they still acknowledge the fact that it's important for the child to have time with the parent.
Is there any other subsets in this regard?
Those are the two main.
Those are the two ones. Well, that makes sense, too, as well. So, there's two major issues that people need to understand, parenting time and legal decision-making. Is there any other things surrounding a custody, a divorce?
Basically, any orders regarding the children. Yeah, the last one is child support. Everybody knows about child support. And here in Arizona, we are kind of known as, our child support guidelines and our payouts that one parent will pay to another are actually pretty low amongst all the other jurisdictions in the country.
Oh, they are?
Arizona has child support guidelines. And the simple way to explain it is the court kind of takes the income of both parties, puts them in a Excel spreadsheet that, that has all the cool formulas in it and whatnot. There's a few other considerations as well. The main one being how much time the child is spending with each parent. Mm. The court calculates the number of days per year that the kid is spending with each parent, and they enter in and push enter, and
that's it.
They get a number, and that's
and voila,
that's kind of where it goes. Now, even within that, sometimes one or the other party can request the court deviate from the child support worksheet that is composed. So child support is simple. Whichever spouse makes the most money generally has to pay the other spouse some type of child support.
Now, if one parent doesn't work,
mm-hmm.
They assign probably a minimum wage type of thing.
Generally, yeah. In most cases, parents, they survive somehow. So you have to attribute them some kind of income. So in most cases, an unemployed parent, if they're able to survive and care for a child, I would generally ask to attribute them minimum wage because they're surviving somehow.
But, I'm sure all sorts of things happen regarding child support. I mean, I suspect that could be a show in itself, all the issues surrounding that, like if someone had a business or something and if there was a trend of income used to be high, now it's low. I mean, there's also, valuation of the business. That might be just splitting up the property. But
yeah, that's property.
Yeah. So, but another question might be if they're not working, they assign a minimum wage. It makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What if there's economic gain somewhere from someone? What if someone is gifted money or whatever the case might be, let's say, allowed to use a house, is that put in the computation as income to them?
No.
Oh, it's not. So gifts don't count. If someone supporting you doesn't count. That's interesting.
Not necessarily.
Have you ever seen a case where if someone is supporting another party, because usually I started thinking minimum wage, as a CPA, I'm doing a calculation in my head. it doesn't cut it, and that could be adverse to the kid.
Well, that would come up in a situation like, let's say we go to trial on the issue of child support, because one parent is claiming that they make this amount of money,
right,
and the other parent is saying, oh, no, they're definitely making a lot more money. And so what you would have to prove up in trial for child support is how much money that parent you're disputing they're making and how much more, where that income comes from. And it could come from something that, you know, you're explaining, as long as it's a steady flow of income.
So if you can prove a steady flow of income, not in an income tax sense, but a gift sense where, you know, if people receive gifts, it's generally non-taxable to the recipient. It could be taxable to the donor. But if someone, let's say extreme case, let's say someone gets economic value, free rent at a house, let's say food and a whole assortment of things that equal $50,000-$60,000 a year,
mm-hmm.
would that not be challengeable in court?
You can absolutely bring that up. Yeah.
What would judge say of something like that? I'm just very curious about that.
Again.
Yeah.
I guess I kind of preface this with all of my answers. Every
yeah.
circumstance is different. So it's kind of hard to exactly what a judge would say in that circumstance.
Yeah, but it's an interesting concept because economics are economics.
Right.
But it depends probably what the law says and maybe prior court cases, I suspect. So, wow, can you believe the time flew? This was so exciting. I can't believe it. Daniel Ortega III, thank you so much. This has been great. People should call you 602-752-0763, 602-752-0763, or email Daniel at DRO, that's Daniel Robert. Is that your middle name?
My middle name is pronounced Raul.
Raul, okay. So DRO, so I just realized that's your email, your middle name too.
Yeah.
So Daniel Raul Ortega, so DRO number 3, law@gmail.com. And it's been a pleasure. This has been exciting. We should do a show perhaps next time on a subtopic of one of these, because I think you could probably go all day on any of these topics.
Right.
Exceptions to the exceptions to the exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And, Daniel, again, thank you so much. This is Breakthrough Thinking live from the Regis Suites. We'll not have actually a Breakthrough Sports tomorrow. We got some special media events, but we'll be back Thursday with Breakthrough Entertainment. Have a good night.